May it please the court. My name is Jason Collins. I'm with the law firm of Diamond McCarthy, representing HLSP Holdings in this proceeding. HLSP appeals a ruling by the Superior Court holding that HLSP lacks standing to pursue a claim for damages caused by Fortune's breach of a contractual promise that was owed directly to HLSP Holdings. The Superior Court's ruling in this respect is incorrect for at least three reasons that I'd like to go through with the court this morning. First, the Superior Court incorrectly held that the contract prohibited HLSP from selling the Fortune stock that it received in the transaction. The contract did not prohibit HLSP from selling the stock that it received in the transaction, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. Secondly, the Superior Court incorrectly held that HLSP's intention to distribute the stock to its stockholders deprived it of the ability to suffer harm. Intent to distribute has no impact on one's ability to suffer injury. Third, the Superior Court incorrectly held that the only injury in this matter at issue was tied to fluctuations in Fortune stock that took place after the distribution of that stock to HLSP's stockholders. HLSP suffered injury at the time of the breach when Fortune failed to take all action necessary to register the Fortune shares for free tradability on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange. With respect to the first point, which is that the contract did not bar HLSP from its ability to sell the shares, the Superior Court failed in making that ruling to reference any specific provision of the contract that barred HLSP from selling that stock.
What effect would selling the stock have on the tax-free reorganization?
To the extent that HLSP had sold the stock, it would not impact the tax-free reorganization because, as a matter of tax law, under Section 368 of the tax code, the reorganization itself refers to the fact that the transfer of the assets of HLSP in the first instance are tax-free in exchange for the shares of Fortune stock that HLSP receives. A subsequent sale of the Fortune stock by HLSP would have tax ramifications for HLSP, but it would not cause the transaction to fail to represent a tax-free reorganization pursuant to Section 368A1C of the tax code.
Did the Superior Court opinion address that issue? Was that another way of asking is, was that a reason why the Superior Court judge found that the sale could not take place or the agreement barred the sale?
It is implicitly in this sense. The Superior Court ruled that the contract barred HLSP from selling the shares, not based on a specific provision of the contract that says you may not sell the shares and as a contractual obligation, but because the contract includes terms that show that the intent of the transaction was for it to be a tax-free reorganization pursuant to Section 368 of the tax code. So since the contract says that the intent of the transaction is to be a tax-free reorg, the court then reads into that, and pursuant to the arguments that Fortune's making on its papers before this court, that somehow barred HLSP from selling the shares. However, a sale of the shares has no impact on the fact that the transaction would remain a tax-free reorg pursuant to the tax law.
Other than that there would be a tax at the entity level.
There would be a tax at the entity level. However, that should have no impact upon this court's determination of whether or not HLSP has standing. As this court
let's assume your argument is right. The court may erred and concluding that HLSP was barred from selling the stock, is that of any consequence to this appeal? Is there any evidence in the record that if HLSP could have sold the stock, it would have?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that question is that it's irrelevant whether or not HLSP intended to sell the shares. There is evidence in the record.
You may think it's irrelevant, but I'm asking if there's any evidence.
There is no evidence.
If there isn't, then I don't understand how this first argument is of any consequence one way or the other, even if you're right.
Understood. There is no evidence that HLSP intended to sell the shares. In fact, HLSP intended to distribute the shares to its shareholders pursuant to a plan of reorganization and a plan to liquidate. However, is this
well,
point
the discussion in the brief that whatever they did had to be consistent with the plan of reorganization, and your argument seems to be the plan of reorganization didn't prohibit it, therefore implicitly it was all right, and the other side says it wasn't in the plan, and if you would have sold them, you would have put everything in jeopardy.
Yeah, the other side's argument, Your Honor, is that if it's not specifically authorized in writing as part of the plan of reorganization, you can't do it. Tax law does not provide that. That's simply not the case. If the agreement does not have to say that HLSP could sell the stock post-exchange in order for you to be able to do that consistent with the plan of reorganization. That is no requirement under the law.
But if you're trying to set up a tax-free transaction and you don't want to litigate it and get audited, you should stick with the plan to the extent it's explicit, shouldn't you? Once you start talking about what's implicit in the plan, you subject yourself to having to defend the whole tax-free nature.
Well, what we've cited to the court is a number of authorities that provide that the target in a reorg of this nature can sell the shares, and there are reasons why they might like to do so, to pay expenses. Specifically, there is evidence in the record that HLSP...
No,
that
my question doesn't deal with, you know, the theoretical. It deals with this particular plan. Do you agree that it wasn't explicitly in the plan, and to the extent you wanted to do something that wasn't explicitly in the plan, you'd have to make your case in defending what you did to maintain the tax-free status?
It's not explicitly in the plan that HLSP could sell the fortune, could or would sell the fortune shares upon receipt. That, however, is not a requirement in order for the transaction to qualify as a tax-free reorg as intended by the parties. We've cited the authorities to the court that show that they could sell, and in fact, there is evidence in the record that shows that HLSP fully intended to distribute shares that it received from Fortune to its creditors to pay off certain debts that it had or expenses that it had in connection with the transaction. That is not specifically stated in the plan, explicitly in the agreement. So the parties clearly intended
to do it.
Would the
creditors say no, we want cash?
I have no reason to believe that the creditors demanded that they wanted cash as opposed to shares, but I guess my point...
Well, could they?
They could have. Absolutely. And HLSP could have sold the stock and provided them with cash as opposed to providing them with shares, and that would not have interfered with the fact that it was a tax-free reorganization.
Total debt outstanding. Was it a significant amount of money?
Your Honor, I don't have that answer right in front of me, but I do believe we have that in the affidavits. If I can turn to it real quick.
Yeah, in that
regard, it looks like there were 397,223 shares of stock that were distributed to creditors in return for legal and other services.
So it's not
insignificant.
Excuse me, so this was an in-kind payment of creditors. So the argument about could have is, again, theoretical.
Well, it's not theoretical in the sense that something that happened here that was fully intended by the parties
was
not explicitly
because it never happened.
Well, it's not theoretical that they did provide 397,000 shares to their creditors, and it's also not theoretical that that was not specifically provided for in the agreement. But yet, it didn't cause it to not be a tax-free reorganization.
Okay.
So, in other words, they're not prevented from being able to do things simply because it's not explicitly stated in the agreement that they're going to do them.
Do any of your arguments require us to make some sort of ruling or interpretation of the federal tax law as it relates to tax-free reorganizations?
They don't, Your Honor. This court's not required to make any sort of ruling regarding the manner in which a plan of reorganization works. What this court can and should do is take a look at the contract and note that there was not a binding contractual obligation on HSB that prevented it from selling the stock, and moreover, any reference to the fact that they were going to distribute the stock to their stockholders was a statement of intent, and we've cited to the court Corbin on contracts that a statement of intent, if it's not stated in such a way to be relied upon by the other party, is not a binding obligation. And one thing I'd like to point out here that I think is very important is that what's happening is provisions related to taxation that were put into the agreement solely for the benefit of HLSP. So I think it's important to keep in mind the tax-free reorganization aspects of this deal were for HLSP's benefit. HLSP is the one that gains the range of elective action regarding what its tax treatment is going to be in the future. There is no detriment to Fortune to the extent that this fails to be a tax-free organization. So the tax provisions are solely for the benefit of HLSP. And those tax provisions
Well, how could it be solely for the benefit of HLSP? If the parties that would suffer the tax consequences would be the shareholders.
HLSP, the provisions, what I'm saying is that they're not for the benefit of Fortune. In other words, when you look to the rule of interpretation and what I've cited in Corbin on Contracts, that a statement of purpose or intent is not a binding obligation on the contracting party unless the opposing party is in a position where they're actually relying upon that particular statement of intent. Fortune here is not relying upon HLSP's failure or refusal to sell the stock once it receives it. It's not relying upon any of the tax treatment provisions of the agreement, because to the extent that something goes awry with respect to the transaction from a tax standpoint, the only result for Fortune is that they get a step up in basis in the assets that they just received, because a taxable transaction would have been beneficial to them from that standpoint. And the argument that is being made by Fortune here, that if it's not specifically stated in the contract that they could sell the shares upon receipt of them, that they're barred from doing it or they would endanger the tax treatment, makes no sense given the fact that it was fully intended by the parties that they were going to, at a minimum, transfer shares to creditors to pay off debts. The other thing that I think...
But even though creditors were paid in kind, is it your position that the requirement of the plan that they liquidate, meaning pay off creditors, implicitly allowed them to sell the stock for that purpose, pay creditors in cash if they chose to do so?
The tax law permits them to sell the shares after they receive them without endangering the tax-free reorganization status. And we've cited a number of authorities. You've got the General Housewares case in which the target corporation sold 25% of the stock that it received from the acquirer.
The tax law, I thought you said it's in the intent of the parties here. So was the intent of the parties such that it would have permitted some of the shares to be sold to pay off creditors?
I think the intent of the parties that we have in the record is that the parties fully intended that they were going to use shares they had received from Fortune to pay off creditors. And we have that both in the Takis affidavit at A30 and in the Bagley affidavit at A25. That is not something that was spelled out in the contract, but yet it is entirely consistent with the plan of reorganization. If you look at the tax authorities that we've cited to the court, that is something that happens on a regular basis. It does not have to be spelled out in the same way that the fact that HLSP could sell the Fortune stock upon its receipt of the stock doesn't have to be specifically spelled out. But I think there's a larger point here.
Were there filing fees for the dissolution? Did the state agency, Puerto Rico, accept shares?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to indicate that they paid filing fees using shares that I'm aware of.
I want to make sure there's nothing subtle in your answer to Justice Risley's question that I missed. As I understood his question, he was asking you whether the parties intended that the shares be used to pay off debts in kind, or whether the parties intended the alternative, that they be sold and cash be used to pay off creditors. And your response was they intended to use the shares to pay off creditors. Is there some subtlety there that you answered it that way?
I'm not trying to be tricky with the court, Your Honor.
I'm easy to trick. So that's how I get it.
No. My response is simply that what the parties did here and what they've stated in their affidavits is that they used shares that they received from Fortune to pay off creditors in kind. I don't have any evidence in the record or reason to believe that there were discussions regarding whether or not they were going to use shares or cash, or that there was a request for cash. But what I'm saying is that the agreement doesn't bar them from using cash.
I understand that argument.
Okay. There's no specific provision in the agreement that bars them. They're all statements of intent regarding what's going to happen with the shares with respect to their plan of liquidation.
Well, you've mentioned the intent of the parties many times. What do we learn from the record where, you know, one of the people involved with Fortune, who's a shareholder, basically writes to Fortune and says, you're not doing what you're supposed to do, when in fact he probably had a lot of input into whether they would do it. It seemed kind of self-serving. What does that have to do with the intentions of the parties, you know, as the delay was going on?
Sounds like you're referring to the relationship among the underlying individuals.
Right, exactly.
We have, as set forth in the complaint, which is in the record, explained that the CEO of Fortune, a gentleman by the name of Rene Mueller, was refusing to allow these shares to be registered. He is called out in the complaint as being a driving force. Renee Mueller was not a principal of HLSP. So it is not as though simply because one of HLSP's principals became the president and other people took roles in the company that all of a sudden they could do whatever they want in that organization, irrespective of what the CEO wants to do. So in terms of the relationship of the parties, I think there was a point made about that below. The Superior Court makes a point about it in its ruling as though there's a conspiracy amidst. But the purpose of bringing the claim in the name of the corporation is because it's a corporate claim. And this court has jurisprudence regarding whether or not a claim is a direct injury claim by creditors as opposed to a derivative claim or a claim that belongs to a corporation. And if a claim is a corporate claim, because it relates to a breach of a promise that was made directly to the corporation that involves, as in this circumstance, where the corporation did not receive what it bargained for in the exchange, it bargained for freely tradable shares. It did not receive freely tradable shares.
Why couldn't the action have been brought on behalf of the shareholders as third-party beneficiaries?
To the extent that the shareholders or stockholders were third-party beneficiaries, then they would have a claim pursuant to the law that specifies that third-party beneficiaries and or the contracting party can bring that claim. That would not divest the corporation of its claim, but either party could bring the claim. But in this case, the contract specifies or it specifically rules out that there are any third-party beneficiaries. So if you look at the there's a provision in the contract specific to third-party beneficiaries that disclaims that there are any.
You're 2 minutes into your rebuttal. Did you want to save your balance?
Yeah, out of time. I'll save that time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. David Jenkins for Appellee Fortune Management. With me at council table is Michelle Gott from my firm, who assisted me on the briefing in this matter. In its opening brief, not so much in its reply brief and not so much here today, HLSP tries to make this case more than it really is. I mean, many litigants obviously try to do so. In its opening brief, HLSP talked about, the consequences of Judge Carpenter's decision is going to have some effect on this court's direct derivative jurisprudence. With respect, that's just not so. All that Judge Carpenter did here was to take a contract, interpreted it, and determined that HLSP did not have standing to pursue the claim set forth in the complaint that they brought.
Could I interrupt for a second?
Yes, Your Honor.
In your client's view, could anybody have successfully challenged the delay in registering that stock?
Yes, Your Honor. As we said below and we stay here now, these individual stockholders, HLSP, absolutely could do so. There were five of them. Three of them are part of Fortune now and do not wish to pursue this claim. This claim is brought essentially on behalf of two of them, Mr. Takas and Mr. Leonard. We told Judge Carpenter below, if Mr. Leonard wants to come into the Superior Court in Delaware and file a suit against HLSP, we will defend on the merits. That option still stands. Mr. Takas, who has about 10 million of the 33 million outstanding shares, however, he can file suit against HLSP individually. We have no dispute over that. But he signed, when he terminated his employment relationship with HLSP, he signed an agreement that any disputes arising over the stock he received from Fortune would have to be brought in the courts in Zug, Switzerland. We didn't pick Zug because it's across the world. That's where Fortune's headquarters is. That's where Mr. Takas had an office. There's reasons for doing that.
Just to follow up on Justice Berger's question, are you saying to put it very precisely, that yes, the no third-party beneficiary clause of the plan or the agreement would have barred a lawsuit by shareholders individually, but your client was willing to waive that provision? Or are you saying that there was no contractual bar to a suit by the individual shareholders?
We do not believe there was a contractual bar, Your Honor. Among other reasons, the HLSP stock was indisputably given to the individual stockholders no later than March of 2006. Once that happened, they could do with it what they wished. Two of them, Mr. Takas and Mr. Leonard, the two people really represented by appellants here, sold some of their stock. They didn't get HLSP to sell it. They sold it. That's part of their complaint. In their underlying complaint, they complain about, among other things, We sold this stock at ridiculously low prices because the stock hadn't been registered yet. That just screams out it's their individual claim. Below, we filed our motion for summary judgment and supported it with an affidavit of Mr. Bagley. They came back with affidavits of Mr. Leonard and Mr. Takas. They knew, because of our argument, that what we were saying is HLSP does not have standing to do this. In their affidavits, both Mr. Takas and Mr. Leonard say, oh, HLSP suffered individual damages. And by this time, they knew that they had to focus on the period between July of 2005, when the agreement was signed, and March of 2006, when they'd received the stock individually. I think they'd accepted it by that time. So they say conclusorily that HLSP has suffered damages. And then they give individual examples. Again, this is a motion for summary judgment. They can't get by on mere conclusory statements. They have to supply facts. They supplied those facts. Every one of those facts in both the affidavits points out how they personally were damaged because they couldn't sell the stock they had in their possession at the unrestricted trading prices on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange.
You and your, I think the introductory sentence to your argument spoke about Judge Carpenter, you know, interpreting the agreement or the plan. Did his decision also involve, you know, critically any consideration of the evidence outside the contract?
Critically? No, Your Honor. He did look at the summary. It's a summary judgment motion. It's not a motion to dismiss, so he could properly look at the other evidence. My interpretation of Judge Carpenter's decision, however, is he interpreted the contract as a matter of law. He did look at and made a reference to Mr. Bagley's affidavit, but it was on his follow-up point. That is, Judge Carpenter's initial point is, reading this contract as a matter of law, HLSP did not have standing to bring damages. His secondary point is, by the way, even if I'm wrong on the first one, I'm paraphrasing, of course, even if I'm wrong on the first one, as a factual matter and an indisputable factual matter, HLSP had distributed the stock to its stockholders by March of 2006. In its complaint, HLSP focuses on time periods in late 2006 and early 2007 when the Fortune stock was trading at very high prices on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange. That's what their complaint focuses on. So Judge Carpenter says, he looked at the complaint and says, this is what they're focusing on. This is at a time which HLSP indisputably didn't have the stock. It couldn't have done anything with it. It didn't have it in its possession. Therefore, as a factual matter, first part is a legal matter, as a factual matter, HLSP suffered no damages at the time period they're focusing on in their complaint.
Didn't the fact that the stock was not registered, assuming that it was intended that the stock would be used to pay off creditors, didn't the action of Fortune in not registering it make it more expensive to pay off the creditors because they had to give them more stock than they otherwise would have?
I do not know, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record on that point. That was never raised below or at any time when a record could be created. So I apologize. I simply cannot answer that question.
Well, that's hypothetically, if it's registered, the stock is more valuable?
Yes, Your Honor.
If it's not registered, it's less valuable?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you had to pay more stock to the creditors when it's less valuable than when it's more valuable to pay off the creditors, right?
That's the part, it's that leap, Your Honor, that I don't know what the answer to is, and there's nothing in the record, because I don't know when the stock was set aside to pay the creditors. That is, you have 33 million shares. The stock set aside for the creditors, by the way, is 1% of the entire stock. You're setting aside stock for the creditors. You have to do this no later than March of 2006 because the individual stockholders want their stock. They don't know how much they can take until you know how much you're setting aside for the creditors. So the amount for the creditors had to be established no later than March of 2006. At what time it was established, I don't know. It's not in the record. Therefore, it could have been established at a time when, for all I know, the stock was trading at very low prices. That's why I cannot answer Your Honor's question directly. We need more factual information on that.
Mr. Jenkins, with respect to the trial court's alternative holding, that is, in any event, there was no harm, no financial harm to the corporation. Is that an alternative holding that buttresses the no standing conclusion, or is that a separate contention that even if there is standing, there's no cause of action here because, there's no damage?
I regard it as the latter, Your Honor. Your Honor can read Judge Carpenter's opinion, obviously, for himself. But we viewed it as a secondary point, a factual point. The first one was, as a matter of law, you have no standing under the agreement. Secondly, factually, based on the allegations in your complaint and based on the facts brought forth in summary judgment, you're complaining about time periods when HLSP indisputably didn't have the stock in its possession and couldn't complain about it. So I regard it as the second of Your Honor's alternatives.
No cause of action.
That's correct, Your Honor. Obviously, I've dealt a great deal with the merits already in answering Your Honor's questions. I will attempt to make the rest of my argument in some sort of coherent fashion. There have been questions from the bench to Mr. Collins this morning about the tax law aspects of the briefing. None of this was raised below, and in our opinion, it should have been. This court may wonder why there's a lack of guidance in Judge Carpenter's opinion about it. He wasn't raised with it, and it should have been. If it was sufficiently important to raise in this court, and it was HLSP's lead-off argument in their opening brief, it should have been raised below and was not. That is, if HLSP thinks that the tax law, the federal tax law, has some effect here, they should have raised it below. Below, HLSP's main argument was the direct derivative claim that they still have here, plus their argument that under Puerto Rican law, a dissolved corporation such as HLSP can bring an action within so many years of its dissolution. The first, direct derivative, is irrelevant. We never get there. The second, we never dispute it. I think Puerto Rican law is similar to Delaware law on that point, but we never argued that below.
Now, and with regard to the direct claim, I got the impression from your earlier answers that there's no problem with the statute of limitations. If the individual shareholders still want to file a direct claim, it would be timely.
Excuse me, Your Honor. May I think about that just a second? I'm trying to think of dates. I was thinking of two things. Number one, I had to remember what was the date and what is the likely statute of limitations to apply. And the second is, did the filing of this lawsuit, which, I don't know what year this is. This is 2008. Yes. This lawsuit, which was originally brought in the Court of Chancery, was indisputably brought within 3 years, approximately, of the time of the agreement. I am not certain. I apologize, Your Honor. I am not certain. I believe that an individual lawsuit now might relate back, and therefore, even if it was otherwise outside the time of limitations, might relate back. But I'm not certain of that. It also might be because Mr. Takis has to bring his suit in the courts in Zug, Switzerland.
Right. I understood that distinction. I'm not trying to digress or get you involved with principles of judicial estoppel. But earlier you said unequivocally, this is not a derivative claim. It's a direct claim. And to the extent it should be brought in Delaware, we're going to defend it on the merit.
Right.
All of which seemed to imply that was still a viable alternative.
Right. It was still a viable alternative when we made the argument to the Superior Court earlier. I had not focused, when I was answering the earlier question, on statute of limitations. My guess is that they're okay, but I'm reluctant to pin myself down without hearing about it. But in any event, this is not something that should come as a surprise. If HLSP or Mr. Takis or Mr. Leonard has let the statute of limitations run, they've known about our argument for a while. We raised this back last fall. If they had a concern about it, as good attorneys, they would have advised their clients, we've got to file this right away. The fact that they lost below, which was always a possibility, and chose to appeal here instead of filing individual suits, if that doesn't help them down the line, I don't think we can be held responsible for that, Your Honor.
So your answer is it's either viable or it's not, but to the extent it's here, this case is here, and their individual suits, direct claims not viable, they made that election themselves.
Thank you, Your Honor. You've said it better than I did, yes. Now, going back again to the tax law arguments that were raised by HLSP here, they never raised them in the complaint. You wouldn't typically. They did not raise them in their answering brief on summary judgment, where you would typically see them if they thought they were important. It is true that in response to one question by Judge Carpenter, HLSP's counsel stated that, yes, the tax laws might apply, but he acknowledged there that there would have been adverse tax consequences to doing so, which is interesting because I believe I heard him say today that there was just the opposite, which I will get to in a minute. Therefore, it was no surprise to Judge Carpenter. There was nothing on the tax law arguments in the papers. In response to one question of his, not as an affirmative argument, but in his response, sort of a throwaway argument to a question of his, he raises, HLSB's counsel raises it. We do not think this is a fair basis to bring it before the Supreme Court. In looking at this court's decision of many years ago.
Well, assuming that it had been fairly raised, would those tax law arguments bear in any material way upon what's before us?
We do not think so, Your Honor. But we had to respond to them. They were raised in the opening brief, and we had to do something. And if the court feels a bit adrift in this tax law, as I certainly do personally, because I don't deal with this every day, and we had to deal with this in the briefs.
Primary argument is based on Supreme Court Rule 8. It wasn't raised below. It's not properly before this court on appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Equitable Trust Company versus Gallagher says that making an argument below without support and then coming to the Supreme Court and filing all these tax law cases is improper. It puts me at a disadvantage, it puts the court at a disadvantage, and it puts Judge Carpenter in a bad place because obviously we haven't asked him. I'm sure he'd be surprised to find out all these tax law arguments on appeal when they none were raised before him below where he had a chance to deal with them. Now, as in response to one of Justice Jacobs' questions, I indicated, but we don't have to get there. Our argument is very simple. The agreement between the parties makes it clear that HLSP was never intended to have the range of action, a range of elective action. I picked that up from this court's opinion in Duncan versus Theratex, which is cited in the opening brief by HLSP. Describes a situation in which someone in HLSP's position, it has the ability, let's say, do we hold the stock, do we sell the stock, do we distribute the stock? It had no range of elective action under the agreement. That agreement was very simple. Promptly after closing, and promptly is in the agreement, HLSP was to liquidate and distribute the stock and its other assets to its stockholders. And then liquidate as part of a tax-free reorganization. The agreement does not give HLSP any ability to do otherwise. Now, in the reply brief, HLSP changes its argument and focuses for the first time
on. Can I ask you a question before you go to their argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
What does the phrase liquidate and distribute the stock mean? Does liquidate modify stock, or liquidate refer to other assets, and distribute stock is a phrase to itself?
I've interpreted it as you liquidate and distribute the stock, sort of two actions taken simultaneously. When a corporation liquidates, implicit within that is it distributes its assets. But distribute modifies stock there, is our interpretation.
I was having some difficulty understanding how you both liquidated and distributed the stock.
Fortune is a Delaware corporation. That's why we're here. But it operates its business in Germany. The principals on that side are German. Sometimes there might be a small language situation. I think Delaware Council, who was not involved in the online papers, would have described it a little bit differently.
You mean this agreement was translated from the original German?
I don't think so, but that the people on the other side, English is not their native language. People on the Fortune side, English is not their native language, and therefore you can get some small discrepancies in the way they write English and the way in a Delaware attorney who knows the difference between liquidation, dissolution, etc., would write an agreement such as this. In the reply brief, HLSP focuses on, we distributed a very small portion, 1% of the stock, to the creditors. Therefore, we had the right to do something else with respect to the stock. They never come out and say it, but implicit in this was that they had the right to sell the stock before they distributed it to the creditors. They never did so. We're talking about a hypothetical here. As Mr. Collins admitted, the stock was distributed to the creditors. It was not sold, and the proceeds distributed. They imply, however, that they had the right to do so. And there's just no basis in the agreement for that. There is nowhere in the agreement where they can say, oh, yes, here's something in the agreement that says we could have taken the stock, we could have sold the stock.
But I thought their position was there's nothing in the agreement that barred them from selling it. And it isn't so much a question of whether they intended to sell it or not, but whether they had the right under the agreement to sell it if they chose to do so.
Correct. And they did not, because they had to distribute. And secondly is the tax-free reorganization part. Here I'm a little over my head. I'm not a tax lawyer, but my general understanding based on what's set forth in the briefs is that a tax-free reorganization, the only certain way you can get a tax-free reorganization is if the assets you receive in the transaction, here Fortune Stock, are then distributed without sale. Anything you do beyond that, it starts to raise questions.
Well, both sides fortunately have told us that we don't have to reach the question of what's appropriate for salvaging a tax-free reorganization here. Do you agree with that?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is a fallback position. I think this court can decide it directly on the fact that the agreement does not give HLSP any range of elective action. It was to promptly, after the closing, it was to liquidate and distribute the stock. And that does not give it a time period to do anything.
There's no elective action in the process of liquidation?
Well, you have liquidation can be done very quickly, as Your Honor knows. It could be done within a day or so. It was not here. It was delayed. We never got into this below, but it was delayed beyond a prompt period. But liquidation could happen within a day or two.
But in terms of how to liquidate, no matter how long it takes, isn't there elective action in that process?
The HLSP would have to decide internally how much of its stock to distribute to each of its five stockholders. Presumably it would be based on their stock interest in HLSP, but there's some contractual basis for doing that within HLSP. But in terms of HLSP having a right to either distribute the stock or sell it, no, Your Honor, it would not have the
power. But liquidation involves more than just the distribution of the stock. It involves paying off the creditors, winding up the affairs of the company,
right,
paying filing fees, whatever it takes to bring it to an end, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So is there elective action in that?
Not in so far as I would understand the term elective action. Elective action to me means you have a couple of different ways of doing it. Here, they were required to liquidate promptly. They didn't have the elective action to keep the company going for a while and see what happened, maybe use it as a vehicle for other purposes. That was not part of the agreement in the plan of reorganization that they signed. So I would not think that they would have elective action with respect to that, Your Honor.
So specifically, they could not sell stock to pay a creditor in cash.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's no basis in the agreement to do so. They had to distribute the stock. The stock, in fact, was distributed.
And if a creditor said no, hypothetically, what would happen?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed
that. If a creditor said, I don't want to have to go sell this stock in Europe or wherever it takes for me to sell it, I want cash to pay my debt.
HLSP did not have the ability to do that. Still keeping with a tax-free reorganization, because once you start selling anything at the HLSP level, you run afoul of the tax laws, or you could run afoul of the tax laws. My point there that I was trying to make is, based on the tax law authorities cited by HLSP, which we've looked at, the only way you can be certain of getting a tax-free reorganization is to do what HLSP did here, that is, take the stock it received from Fortune and distribute it. Distributed most 99% of it to its stockholders, 1% to its creditors, and not sell anything. Once you start to sell, you run afoul of the federal tax laws, or you could be running afoul of them.
Well, your colleague says they've cited many cases that stand for the opposite proposition.
I'm relying specifically on what they've cited, Your Honor. With respect, he is incorrect. Let me explain it a little more detail. There are arguments that pursuant to a plan of reorganization, if the plan of reorganization said you can do certain things other than distribute the stock, let me pause there and say that this is hypothetical. That's not what this document said. But assuming it did so, if the plan of reorganization says it's okay, there is an argument that it's still tax-free. That doesn't help HLSP here because the plan of reorganization clearly doesn't say that. So in their reply brief, they shift targets yet again and say, well, this is citing the Ginsburg and Levin book, which we had a great difficulty finding, but we found it, and says that maybe, and I emphasize the maybe, even without a plan of reorganization, sales can occur in certain circumstances and still be tax-free. And they cite three of them. One of them is paying debts of the corporation. Second is satisfying appraisal claims. Didn't occur here. And third, where stockholders can't receive a stock distribution because of regulatory constraints. These are three, according to their own authorities, that say maybe if you had one of these three, maybe you could sell stock and get away at the tax-free level. The problem for HLSP is none of this applies here. And none of this helps them, HLSP, say, yes, we had a range of elective
action. As I understand your point from your argument in your brief, the cases seem to suggest, and there's a wide range of opportunities for adopting a plan of reorganization that would be tax-free. But whatever you decide to pick from the wide range, then you have to stick with the plan if you want to get the tax-free determination. And you're saying here they picked a very narrow choice that did not involve selling the stock. So what they could have done in adopting the plan is irrelevant. If they want to get tax-free treatment, they have to stick with the plan they picked, and that was distributing the stock.
That's correct, Your Honor. Question one of the justices to Mr. Collins was essentially, isn't this the only safe way you can proceed? And the answer to that is yes. The authorities they cite are maybe, if you're lucky, if the IRS doesn't challenge it, there may be the things you can do to play around with the plan of reorganization, but you're running risks on this. The only safe way is to proceed as Your Honor suggested. That is, if it's in the plan of reorganization, you can do it. If it's not, you can't. I have nothing further. If the court has additional questions, I will do my best to answer them. Otherwise, thank you for your patience, and thank you for listening to my tax law arguments.
Just point the court briefly to those authorities that I did reference to you regarding the fact that HLSP could sell the stock, and we'll see just how maybe it is that you can do this. The Joint Committee 1984 Blue Book regarding the statutory scheme under 368A1C specifically states that that Congress did not intend to preclude C reorganization treatment to a target corporation merely because it does not distribute the property it received from the acquiring corporation immediately after the reorganization, so long as it distributes it, either such property or any property received on the sale or exchange of such property. Then we also cited Mertens, Section 4381, where it says the target corporation may sell or exchange property received from the acquiring corporation or other property held by it immediately after the reorganization.
Mr. Collins, what's your position with whether the tax issue was ever presented to Judge Carpenter?
Judge Carpenter specifically asked me at the hearing, and it's available in the transcript, as to whether or not HLSP could sell the shares. And I responded directly to him that absolutely HLSP could sell the shares, and I indicated to him that there would be tax ramifications of doing so. And I think before this court today, I indicated that to the extent that HLSP sold the shares, there could be tax consequences, but I also specified to the court that it would not result in affecting in any way the fact that it's a tax-free reorganization, because that is with respect to whether or not there is tax on the sale of the assets from HLSP to Fortune in exchange for the stock.
Now,
I
understand. Let me focus my question. This was briefed before Judge Carpenter. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then there was an argument before Judge Carpenter. As I understand the record, none of the tax issues we've been debating were in any of the briefs, but at the argument, a tax question came up. And that's the only extent to which this is in the record in the Superior Court.
Yes, Your Honor. The issue is that before the Superior Court, as this Court's aware, you get 4 pages in your brief. So you have to cover the issues that are presented by the motion. And then the issues with respect to the tax, whether the tax-free reorganization, only come up. Okay, they're only relevant to this entire proceeding to the extent that you accept the premise that Fortune offers that the tax-free reorganization provisions of the agreement were somehow binding on HLSP so as to restrict its ability to sell the shares because it uses the terms we plan for this to be a tax-free organization. I do not accept that, and the agreement does not provide that. It does not bar HLSP from doing anything of the sort. And thus, you have to actually accept the premise of Fortune that it's a binding obligation not to sell the shares before you even get into whether or not a tax reorganization would allow you to sell the shares. Well,
can I ask you about that proposition for a minute? How do you interpret the term liquidate and distribute stock?
I interpret that phrase, Your Honor, as the party's intent that HLSP itself was going to liquidate as an enterprise and then distribute whatever assets it had, and at the time it had shares of stock. I think to your point, I'm not making the argument that you should interpret the agreement to say that they were going to liquidate the shares of Fortune stock that they had received before distributing them out to the stockholders. I don't think that's what the provision is intending based upon the way that these agreements are typically drafted. And I don't think it's because the parties to the agreement spoke other languages. I think the parties that were actually negotiating this spoke pretty good English.
Can I turn to the question about the individual stockholders arguably having a claim based upon not having registered stock? It appears that your opponent has left the door open and has made it clear that such a claim could have been pursued, and yet instead HLSP is pursuing something that is maybe a little more tenuous as a claim. Can you explain that to me?
Yes, Your Honor. It's because pursuant to this court's jurisprudence, this claim is an entity claim. It's a derivative claim. So my position is that if one of the shareholders tried to pursue this claim as a direct injury claim, it would be poured out in front of the court for a lack of standing because the injury in this case, because I think this kind of gets buried in all of the tax discussion.
Okay, but I'm trying to get a kind of a common sense understanding of, you know, why when there is arguably a substantial claim based upon failure to register the stock, an injury that was suffered by individual stockholders or by the entity, but let's say arguably injury suffered by the individual stockholders for their inability to sell the shares at an appropriate price, don't you pursue both claims to see which one there is standing for?
Robert, I represent the company. Now, to the extent that one of the individual shareholders wanted to pursue their claim, they could attempt, but I'm telling you on behalf of the company and based upon my understanding of Delaware law, they can't because it's a entity claim. And the complaint in this matter was very clear, paragraph 23, that the shares of Fortune stock that HLSP received were impaired as a result of the breach by Fortune of its obligation to take all action to register them for free tradability. Those shares were impaired. So the injury in the first instance, no matter how you look at this case, and this is what I think is getting buried in all the tax discussion, the injury in the first instance is at the entity level. And once you have that, the fact that they have impaired shares that they've received from Fortune, and Fortune has breached its obligation to it, then at that point it's an entity claim, and there's nothing that a shareholder can do by trying to bring its own suit to convert that claim. And the fact that the company liquidated, I think it was referenced earlier, The liquidation statutes in Puerto Rico are the same as the ones in Delaware. The fact that it liquidated does not divest the company somehow of the claim. The company has to pursue it or lose it.
Well, explain why the company had a claim if under the plan the company was always contemplated simply as a conduit to get something to the shareholders, either the stock or the money. If the company's saying because it wasn't registered and readily transferable, I couldn't get something of more value to the shareholders, but it was never something the company was going to keep. It was something that was always going to be passed through to the shareholders in cash or kind. So why does the company have a claim?
It's because of the rulings in American General versus Continental Airlines and Duncan that specifically say that intent to distribute has no effect on one's ability to suffer injury. It's not the intent to distribute that the court has to look into to determine whether HLSP was going to sell the shares or they were intending to actually pass these shares on to someone else. That's not what determines standing. You have to look to determine where did the injury occur in the first instance. And on the record before this court, you have a number of things in the record that show you that there was injury in HLSP's while the shares were in HLSP's hands.
But you remember in Tooley and Donaldson, we talked about who the recovery goes to. In this situation, if your client, the company, prevails, do they get to keep anything?
Whatever the company recovers, like any company, it ultimately will benefit the stockholders of that company. And that's a point, actually, that's made, again, in this court's jurisprudence in Feldman, is the fact that the ultimate harm is suffered by the stockholders has no bearing on whether or not you view this as a direct injury claim or as a derivative claim. So I think if you go back to Feldman and you look at the principles of determining direct versus derivative, who ultimately suffers this harm or who ultimately benefits from the recovery is of no consequence.
Thank you, counsel, for an interesting and well-presented argument. We'll stand in recess and take the case under advisement.
All right.